Leo Pera, all of you know, you've probably been in touch with him before by many means, and you've seen him. Leo is, of course, the chief operations officer for the assembly, and he's also functioning as the secretary, the official secretary of proceedings, and will ensure that all proceedings are done perfectly for our record. You've got a public hearing schedule, and I know there's some comment about that, and tomorrow morning we're going to spend a little bit of time. Leo's going to come to the podium, and we're going to talk a little bit about the public hearings and any kind of tweaking that we might want to do that that might be possible. The public is here today, some in this hall and some in room 320, and I think that we have told you, but we should tell the public, that if they wish to view after the plenary session, if they wish to view one of the small group sessions, they can only do it in this room. One small group session will be in the inner circle, and they have to sit two or three rows back. We found last time, regretfully to say, that some of the public interfered a little bit with the discussions that went on, and of course that can't happen. I want to very quickly, I could spend an hour on this, I want to very quickly, briefly report on the evaluation of the first sessions. Remember, you took about 15 minutes or so to complete an evaluation. It was enormously useful. Just look at the breakfast this morning. It was a little bit better. And so we listened to your evaluations, and the breakfast, I understand, from Leo and Kathy is even going to be better next Saturday and Sunday. So we do. But the main thing, the main positive comments is that you were enormously complimentary to the staff, enormously complimentary to Ken, who made the major presentation, and to the facilitators, the discussion group leaders. Those were all very gratifying. The other thing that ranked right up there with all those things that you said that you liked best about it, and I think this was probably the most common volunteered statement, is how much you enjoyed meeting other members from all over British Columbia. Right up at the top. That was something that I maybe was a bit of a surprise to you or something, but that was obviously one thing that that really made a big impact. The other thing was a lot of people mentioned was a very positive attitude of everybody that was here and the kind of respect that everybody showed for everyone else. And a lot of you commented on this facility as a great place to work. Among the suggestions for improvement, well, breakfast hit number one. Checkout time, we listened to that, and we got the hotel to go by an hour and got that extended a little bit. Some of you found the media sometimes a little bit intrusive, but it wasn't. But you understood why the media was here, because it was an important event. So that's about that. Those are the announcements. We had a great McLean story this week, three pages of McLean's and a great picture, and I know a lot of you have seen it, and there are copies around, and that's great to see. I also want to indicate that a visitor here today and a visitor at every session will be Ken McKinnon. Ken, could just put your hand up there, stand up. Ken is the Commissioner for Electoral Reform or on Electoral Reform for the Yukon, and they are going to observe what we're going to do here in British Columbia. So that's my announcements. We promised that we would have a short period for questions, questions that are basically about the process, not about the questions you'd want to ask Ken about the substance of electoral reform, but any questions you might have about the process and where we're going. I have one from in advance, just to indicate, from Wolf Schultz. He emailed my question. He said, "Could you answer this in the in the question period?" Wolf, well, there you are, same place as last time. What is our mandate? What is it not? In particular, he wanted to know what is the possibility of electing our premier as part of our mandate. Should we be discussing whether or not we should elect the premier? And the quick and the easy answer to that is no. That's not part of our mandate. Our mandate is, how do our votes determine who sits in the legislature? And we are to stick to the parliamentary system. And in the parliamentary system, the premier comes from those elected to the legislature. So that's the answer to that. Any other questions? George.
On the public hearings, do you prefer that we pick places that are close to our home, or would you rather that we pick places further away?
Leo is going to lead a discussion on that tomorrow morning. The quick answer to that, and Leo will get me if I'm not quite regular. We'd like you to have your certainly in your own area. We'd like to be in your own area. And then your second choice should be somewhere near, or if you wish to go somewhere else, make it as your choice. Is that the right answer, Leo? Leo said I'm right, so there I failed. Really good.
Thank you.
Any other questions of that sort or whatever that happen to be on your mind? Well, Ken, I just think they're so excited about your and Campbell's presentations. So you've got to give me a few minutes, so I've got to deal one more bit of business. But I think they don't want it. They don't want me to talk anymore. They want you guys to come on. We do have to deal with, I just have to introduce a piece of business. And that is the matter of the recommendation 3. And you have it in your, this is the recommendation regarding whether there should be presentations to the assembly as a whole. What I'm going to do in about 1 minute now is to explain to you why it's here and then encourage you to discuss it amongst yourselves over the day. And then tomorrow we are going to spend about 10 minutes on it and have a discussion of it and to see whether there's agreement as to what we should do. Now, just as background, the recommendations we got from the BC government are as follows on this quote, "Citizens' Assembly should consult British Columbians by holding public hearings." That's what we're going to do. Secondly, from the Order in Council Terms of Reference for the Citizens' Assembly on Electoral Reform, quote, "The Citizens' Assembly must consult with British Columbians and provide British Columbians with the opportunity to make submissions to the Citizens' Assembly in writing and orally in public meetings." Okay. And therefore, there is no requirement to hear presentations to the assembly as a whole. Now, as I'm told by Susanna, this is in your yellow folder. Have you found it? Just next to blue. Yeah, you've got it there. It's in your yellow folder. And it's the heading is Advocacy Presentations to Assembly, Recommendation Number 3. And the recommendation that is there is that on the first weekend in September, the first day of the first weekend in September, that we should, or it's recommended that we have presentations to this assembly as a whole. So the people would get up, stand here for 5 or 10 minutes or whatever, and make presentations to the assembly on what they think we ought to do or what decision we ought to make. We're not obliged to do that. Members of the public can write submissions, and they can go to public hearings. But in addition to that, should they come to the assembly and speak? Now, you may have a chance to look at that over the next while, not while Ken and Campbell are speaking, of course. That would not be right. But over lunch and coffee breaks and in your discussion groups, by the way, you might want to talk about this because tomorrow we're going to have a discussion of it and to see whether we have an agreement as to whether we should do that or not. Is that clear? Any questions about what we're doing there? Okay, great. Then it is my pleasure now to turn it over to Ken Carty.
Good morning. Nice to see you back. You know, I came into the hotel last night and saw a few faces and thought, gosh, has it been 2 weeks already? Time seems to have flown by. I'm just going to talk for a minute or two this morning, and Campbell's going to do the major presentation. But I thought it would be useful just to kind of put it in context and let us know where we're at and where we're going. I know a number of you have been working with David Farrell's book in the last week or two. Some of you found it a great sleep aid, I'm told. Others have struggled, but that's okay. We've got lots of time, and we're even going to get David here to shoot at later in the session if we like. But if we can get this overhead to work, I thought we would just remind ourselves where we're at and where we're going over these 6 weeks. We talked a little bit last week about political values and the kind of values we have as a group and that we envision that would make British Columbia the kind of political community we want it to be. And we talked a little bit about some of the criteria for assessing electoral systems that really kind of hook to those values. Today we're really going to talk about some of the kind of institutional governmental framework within which we're operating. Jack talked a few minutes ago about the mandate. The mandate says quite clearly we can produce a system that is compatible with the parliamentary system and the Constitution of Canada. That allows us to do some things and gives us lots of flexibility. It rules out other kinds of things. And so we need to be kind of clear about that framework and how that works and how these institutions work. And Campbell's going to talk about some of that this morning around parliamentary government. I'm going to talk a little bit about political parties this afternoon because they're the kind of institutions that make all that stuff work. They're the institutions that make legislatures work and make elections work, as we know it. And then tomorrow morning, we're going to kind of put that in context of British Columbia, what we've done in the past, how we've changed, how we haven't changed, what are the kind of issues that have got us in the way our system is working now to where we're at. Then, of course, the next 2 weeks, we're really going to get into the nitty-gritty, into the deep glue of electoral systems. The next session, then, moving out of this, these first couple of weeks, will get us into thinking about electoral systems and two particular families of systems the first weekend, majority systems and plurality systems. And those are really the first three chapters of Farrell's book, if you want to reread it. Come on, Doug. Doug wants to reread it. The fourth weekend, we're going to look at the other families of electoral systems, the other kind of range of options we have around proportional representation systems, transferable vote systems, and mixed systems. And they flow in three chapters. And we're going to kind of wander through those chapters gently. There's illustrations and there's examples, and try and make some kind of sense of it and try and think of what they would look like if we wanted to use them in British Columbia. Because after all, the way a system works in Germany or Bavaria or Northern Denmark or the South Island of New Zealand is not necessarily the way it will work in British Columbia. Our societies have similarities, but they also have differences. And then, of course, in the last weekends, we'll talk about what will happen if we try and change and what are the dynamics of that process. And then where do we think we are? You know, what have we got from all this? So that's kind of a route map. I think it's helpful just to kind of remind us where we're at. It's a kind of longer journey. We don't have to have it all figured out by the end of 10:30. We're not going to, and certainly drifting through a book like Farrell's, there's no kind of rush to get it all down in the first hour. We'll be coming back to some of these kinds of things in lots of different ways and asking different kinds of questions, and it's there just as a kind of resource and backup, so not to worry about that. Well, this morning we're really going to talk about the kind of system of government we have. The kind of parliamentary government we have and the way that parliamentary government works in this country, because, of course, it does work differently in other places where they have different kinds of arrangements. And the discussion is going to be led by my colleague, Campbell Sharman, this morning. I haven't had a chance to introduce him to you. Many of you have met him in lots of ways last weekend. Campbell grew up in Australia, did a law degree in Adelaide in South Australia, and then went off to the London School of Economics. But then saw the light and came to Canada to do graduate work and did doctoral work in political science at Queen's University in Kingston, where he wrote a very important study of the Supreme Court of Canada. Then he came to British Columbia and taught at the University of Victoria. But I suppose the appeal of kangaroo soup or whatever was too great, and he went back to Australia for a number of years, where he had a distinguished career at the University of Western Australia. But a few years ago, other kinds of attractions brought him back to British Columbia. And he has been associated with our department at the University of British Columbia since that time. He really is an outstanding expert in a number of these areas. And so I'm delighted to welcome here, and I'm sure you will. And we're going to learn quite a lot about parliamentary government this morning from Campbell. So Campbell, please.
Okay, as advertised. But just when I wait until my folder. Well, Ken did a really excellent job last time explaining the general context of elections and what we expect for them and whatever. My job is basically to go over the institutional backgrounds. It's all very well to think about elections, but elections for what? And in a broad way, how do elections relate to assemblies and to parliamentary government in particular? I don't know if you looked at any of the submissions, but many of the submissions on the website sometimes don't Well, ask questions, make assumptions that elections do some things or that our institutions can be easily changed. Maybe they can, but the major function of this assembly is to, as Ken said, and as Jack said, is to translate seats into votes into seats in the institutions we have. So it's important to know what those institutions are. Okay, now, clearly, what we're about is keeping governments responsive. That's what elections are for. But we need to also look at representative assemblies. We need to look at how parliamentary government works. We need to think a little bit about partisan majority government. Now, Ken will do this again this afternoon, or we'll take it in much greater detail. And finally, we need to think about coalition and minority governments, because depending on the electoral system, that may affect the disposition of support in the parliament, and that may affect the kinds of governments we get. I should say a lot of material can be found in the excellent glossary, which you can peruse. You'll also notice that at the back of the materials for this section, the slides, there's a list of references. I don't think you really... It's not vital that you look at them, but those references will give... there's a reference to a couple of really old books. Old but good. It's the theme of the instructors. You should find them in any public library. You find them secondhand bookstores, whatever. The book by Dawson and the book by Mallory. And if you want to pursue the general ideas about parliamentary government, that's not a bad place to look. Now, it's a matter of taste. I think you'll get plenty from this, from the materials. And again, as Ken has stressed, it's the general view you need, not to prepare for an exam or anything explicit. Okay, let's take the first one. Yes, you've got the slides and you've got a space to make notes on them, or you've got an I'm sure you've found that. Okay, now the idea about keeping governments responsive, the idea is that they can be replaced at periodic elections. That's the great advantage about democracy, is that you don't have to have a revolution to change the governments. There's a procedure for orderly change of regime. But... and these aren't the things we're dealing with, but they're also very important. You also need a constitutional framework which limits what government does. You don't want the police turning up in the middle of the night and seizing boxes of things without without justification. You also want the laws that you have, you want them made by a body which has the authority to do that, a representative assembly of the country. And you also want, very, very important, you want freedom of speech so you can criticise the government, say rude things about office holders, assembly so that you can meet and discuss these things in public and complain, and association, that you can form groups which want to push a particular view, have particular policies, and that you can do this again in public. So we're concerned with the first one, but all those other three are equally important. But let's stick with our main goal. What about representative assemblies? What do we want from a representative assembly? What should it represent? Well, the first thing is, well, somehow it should represent the range of views in the community. Okay, that's easily said, but you say, well, is that the only thing we want them to do, just to sit there and express their views? No, we want them to express a variety of interests in the community too. To if there's a particular geographical or occupational or whatever group that wants to make a point, maybe that is the place that it should be there. And in a parliamentary system, as we see, the assembly is also supposed to support a government and provide an opposition. And then, well, that's true, but what about making decisions in the public interest? Isn't that also what's an assembly supposed to do? And then, of course, if we have a system dominated with parties, then shouldn't those views be, shouldn't that be the forum where political parties make their points and express their views? Now, once you've got a list like that, the question is, can you have all of them? Do you have to have all of them? Can you have some? Or have we missed the point entirely? Now, the idea is not to come to a conclusion. You can talk about this in the groups. But in many ways, we expect our representative assemblies to do a range of things, some of which may not be compatible with the other. And in a very indirect way, or maybe not so indirect way, the electoral system can affect the kinds of things which the assembly represents. Okay, well, let's look at quite apart from what it's supposed to do, what do they actually do? Well, for all assemblies, that's all elected bodies, whether they're in our system or in non-parliamentary systems, their major job is to make laws, authoritative statements of policy which are binding. That's why it's called a legislature. The Latin for law is legis, so legislatures, that's why it's the legislative assembly. It makes laws. That's its prime purpose. It's also the source of authority for the raising and spending of public funds. No taxes, one of the major principles, throwing tea in Boston Harbor and jumping up and down in other times of history. People said we shouldn't have to pay taxes unless it's done by a representative body which we can affect. So raising funds must be authorized by the assembly. And equally important, but separately, spending funds. That when the government spends funds, it should be authorized by the assembly. Another thing is, it should be there to provide a forum for being rude about the government, for saying, what did you do with that money? Why hasn't this worked? Why aren't you doing that? When you went on that trip overseas, what were you actually doing? And finally, it's a forum for public discussion. Something happens, you want to discuss it, freely and openly. And one of the characteristics of assemblies is that you can say anything you like. Sometimes it's abused, but it's a major characteristic of assemblies is that the laws of defamation do not apply. So you can say anything. And, of course, the reason for that is that if you could make laws to restrain what the assembly members could say, then governments could muzzle the representatives. So it's a very powerful weapon. It's a privilege which has to be used carefully, but it's really, really important. Otherwise, the assembly doesn't work properly. Okay, now let's look at a particular group of assemblies, because that really deals with assemblies in general. That's not just our system or a parliamentary system. It's all assemblies do that. Now, we get a particular version of them. We have parliamentary government. And before we get around to that, seems pretty obvious, but what is government? When people talk about the government, what do they mean? Note the information in the glossary. It's a fine glossary. Does it mean, I wonder who wrote it, all the agencies in the public sector? That is it all the bits, all the institutions which are not public? Which are not private. Everything that's in the public sector. So that's a huge wedge of activity of institutions in the system. Or, a slightly smaller group, is it all the government departments and the people who see themselves as part of the public service? Because don't forget, a lot of the public sector is not, like universities and hydro and who knows, other bits and pieces, are not parts of departments. So there's public sector in general, then the activities like the Department of Health and Education and whatever, which are responsible to a minister, and are set up as departments. Or is government the most important elected officials, such as the Premier and ministers? Now, when we say the government should think about doing that, that's usually the group we mean. When we talk about throwing the government out, that's what we mean. We mean the key elected officials that are supposed to steer the machinery of states and how the provinces run. That's what we mean by the government. But just note that the government, formally, because Canada is a monarchical system, as is Australia, that much of the activities of government are done in the name of the Crown, and in this province it's done in the name of the Lieutenant Governor. It's a very technical, narrow sense which normally is not needn't worry about, but just note it is there. So normally, when I talk about the government, when you're discussing the government, changing the government. It's the third one that's the critical one, the most important elected officials. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Is there a reason we have to keep the monarch system around? I mean, we don't actually follow any orders of this. I mean, why do we keep it around if it serves no purpose anymore?
Well, the short answer is because it's too hard to change. And the second answer is because it's a system that works pretty well for the government of the day. It puts an air of mystery around what governments do. And one is, as you'll see a bit later on, one of the interesting things about our system is that the most important offices of the executive, that's the government of the day, are not set out in any constitutional rules. And if you're not set out in any constitutional rules, like the Premier's not, then that means you can't be difficult to hold you to account. But this is a system we've inherited. It's a bit like the Trinity. You don't want to think about it too closely. It's just... Okay. Okay, what about parliamentary government? What's parliamentary government? Well, it means that the key government officers, that's we've talked about, the Premier and the Ministers, are chosen from and accountable to the Assembly. That's you elect a body, a legislative assembly, and from that group of people you pick the Premier and the Ministers, and they are accountable to that group. That means that a government only stays in office, in power, if it has majority support in the Assembly. So if a government, in that sense, if the Premier, Ministers, lose a majority support in the Assembly, that's the end of them. They must resign. And the third thing is that when we vote for an Assembly, we choose both the members of the Assembly and the members of the government, at least potentially. Okay, so it's a single package, not like the US, where you vote for a president separately, and you vote for Congress separately. In the parliamentary system, both here and in all kinds of places that have them, and the parliamentary system is the most popular way of structuring representative democracy in the world. It's the biggie. The president is a kind of minor variation, a kind of George III aberration. But parliamentary systems... when you vote for a representative and for a potential government. You vote indirectly for the government, not directly. Okay, what are the consequences of that? Well, the first thing is that the Assembly can force the government to resign. It can say, we don't like what you're doing, we don't like the cut of your jib, we're going to vote against you, and we're going to say, go away. And if the government loses support, it falls. The Assembly also, it can say, well, we'll keep you in office, but we don't like that particular piece of legislation. Take it away, do it again, amend it. Okay, so the Assembly needn't throw out a government to change the law or to stop the government passing its legislation. And, very importantly, a parliamentary process, by the fact of having the government in the Assembly, it generates an alternative government. It generates an opposition. So, usually, during the Assembly, there's no question about what happens if the government falls. You know there's another team to take over. Now, as we'll see, that isn't always the case, but generally speaking, that's what happens. A parliamentary government generates both a government and an opposition in the Assembly. And finally, Parliament tests leaders and those who aspire to leadership. Now, of course, I have to say that because that is usually the case, but Canada is a bit of an exception in that some people who work for car parts companies and things want to become leaders and wouldn't know which side of the Parliament they had to stand on if they won government, I think. Probably that's a bit unfair. But what it means is that generally speaking, Parliament certainly tests leaders. As if you're in Parliament, you're fiercely scrutinised. You can't escape being asked questions and being forced to perform. So it's a real forum for testing. Just imagine about George George Bush, if he went to a parliamentary system, he would be put under very different strains from a situation where he only has to hold press conferences when he feels like it. Parliamentary government, the leader cannot escape. He or she must answer questions. And usually, the opposition leader is hardened in that way too. Or toughened, whatever. An aside, why is the Premier such an important office? And how is the Premier chosen? I have a little note here that says, stop for questions. Any more questions? I should say, I will have a section at the end. I've factored in so people can ask questions. But yes, Wilf.
May I ask the question is, who is testing the parliament leader or the future premier?
A group of people who very much want his or her job.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
So it's the, you've got, I mean, some of my best friends are politicians, but one of the characteristics of a politician is that they believe that they should be premier. Okay. So if they see someone who is premier, they want to ask them hard questions and force them to explain why they're doing what they're doing. Okay. Sorry, another question. Where was that? Yes, David.
Yeah. One of the points in your previous slide was that the Assembly can force a government to resign. How often has that happened in BC?
As you will see, pretty infrequently since 1903.
So it's really not a practical consideration in BC?
Well, when you say practical, it's always there. It's yeah. like the ability of the...
In theory.
Well, not in theory is the wrong word. It is there. It may not be used. It's like having a car jack, okay, or a wheel brace, okay? You may never use it. And if you do have to use it, you may get something else to do it. But nonetheless, it's there. And on occasions, it's important. And as we'll see, if you change the electoral system, then some of these questions may become less hypothetical. Yes.
I'm going to follow up to what Clara was asking about. It's this idea of non-confidence that if in a parliamentary system, if the parliament, some of the members believe that the leader is not doing a good job, they have the option to toss out that government by voting in a new leader of that particular group within the parliament that's already been elected. On the other side of that, what Clara was asking, is it possible or is it even considered where our lieutenant governor, who's responsible to the monarchy, do they have the power to toss out the government of the time? If the government is not seen to be doing a good job and the monarchy is not happy with what's happening, does the lieutenant governor have any power to remove the government?
Well, again, there's a short answer and a slightly longer answer. The short answer is yes. As happened in Australia in 1975, the representative of the Crown can say, go away. You're fired. But that is very, very, very unusual. And in Canada, and Ken can correct me, is unprecedented in the sense that in recent times. And I'm not sure. It's the result of having a monarchy. The Crown does not play that role. The Crown acts, representative of the Crown acts on advice. And the people who hold that office believe they only act on advice. So, yeah. But actually this slide maybe answers some more of the question. The Premier is the person asked by the Lieutenant Governor to form a government which can maintain majority support. So what happens after an election? The person who holds a majority, supposing it's a new government, calls on the Lieutenant Governor or is asked to call on the Lieutenant Governor in Victoria, and she says to him, now she knows he's the leader of the party that's got the most seats, but she will say, can you assure me that you can form a government that has majority in the Assembly? And Premier Campbell said, yes. So she hands him a commission and says, right, off you go. Come back in a while with a list of people who will form your government, and that group, Premier and the ministers, have the authority to act in the name of the Crown as long as they follow certain rules. So they become the government. Okay, so government's formed. That's why the Premier's important. He or she is the major link between this formal part of the executive, formal part of the system, and the bit that does all the real work. So that's why, as you see, the Premier is the link between the political executive and the Lieutenant Governor. The Premier operates the formal machinery of state, or is a critical player in that. The Premier is head of government, the Lieutenant Governor is head of state. And if the Premier resigns or is thrown out, so do all the ministers. So when the Premier goes, they all go. It's not a matter of choice. They cease to become ministers. So the Premier is the king pin, or queen pin, in the system. That's why the Premier is important, and that's the Premier gets that role because he or she can guarantee that he or she has the support of a majority in the Assembly. Okay, now why is this responsible government? Because governments are subject to, you've got to have a majority to continue. So they're responsible that way. You can't spend any money unless the Assembly gives you authority. So if you don't get the authority from the Assembly, you can't spend money, you can't raise it, and you can't spend it. You can't have any new laws unless the Assembly agrees to them, or you can't amend old ones. And you're forced to answer questions about what government's doing, and the Assembly can set up committees, and they may want to inquire into things too. And they have a fair amount of authority. They usually have the same authority as the Parliament itself to look into things. Okay. And, of course, whenever something happens unexpected, the Assembly can require the government to discuss matters of public importance. Not that the government's done anything yet, but why hasn't it done this and what does it plan to do on that? So responsible doesn't mean that they're especially careful or whatever. I think it's an unfortunate phrase, but that's what the books say. They talk about responsible government. They really mean that they're chosen from and that they can't avoid awkward questions from the Assembly. And if they want to do things, they've got to have the Assembly's consent. Suggested I stop each time. I'm not 100% sure about that. Has anyone got any questions? So, to a certain extent, it is run as a series, but yes.
Yes. to some degree, going back to David's question, with regards to vote of non-confidence, is any vote a potential vote of non-confidence, or is it specific to particular types of questions?
The government distinguishes between those things which it makes a matter of confidence and those which it doesn't. So it is possible for a government to be defeated and say, okay, that was just a mistake, or okay, well, that was, we knew that was going to happen. You don't really want to get rid of us, and we'll hold a vote of confidence tomorrow and then everybody votes for it. It happened in Britain quite a lot, where there was a very big backbench, or where there was a very small backbench and some members of the governing party were a bit stroppy. So they would vote against the government on a particular measure they didn't like, and then they'd vote for the government when it was a matter of confidence. In small parliaments, smaller parliaments, and in practice in Canada by and large, is that almost everything is a vote of confidence, other than when the government says this is a free vote, we're not going to impose party discipline, you can vote on it as you choose, but those matters, which are matters of government policy, and great bulk of things are, you have to vote for the government. Okay, if Paul Martin suddenly introduced something, an ordinary bill, and he was defeated, that would be major headline news. Wouldn't necessarily have to resign. He'd probably have a vote of confidence, but it would be regarded as a very severe blow. Okay. Yes, Julie.
In recent history, we've had premiers resign in British Columbia. Did all the ministers have to go with them as well? They did. I didn't recall that.
They may come back again in a different under a different regime, but yes.
So when Glenn Clark resigned, all of his ministers went?
Yes. Okay. Actually, some premiers have tried to use this to avoid having a cabinet reshuffle. They've because it's a bit painful. They didn't want to tell someone they fired them. So what they would do, they would ask the lieutenant governor for a... They said, look, I'm going to resign, and then I'm going... Then I want you to ask me back again. And with a slightly different team, and then I can tell the people who missed out, I'm sorry, it was just one of those things. But yes, they all go. Yeah. Okay. Once you have disciplined parties in the system, the dynamics change, and this gets back to David's point. I'm sorry, another question. Fred? Yes, Fred.
Oh, I'm on. Yes, when did party discipline first begin? It would seem to me that the assembly would function far better and would serve its purpose if there wasn't that strict party discipline. What can you answer that?
Well, to a certain extent, Ken will talk about this afternoon. But if you've got an assembly with 101 members and you want to make that assembly work and come to decisions, then you have to have a rule about how decisions are made. And say if it's an assembly of 101, then you say a majority will prevail. And once you've said that, then there are incentives to maintain a majority. And if you're in a parliamentary system and you need that 51% to stay in office, there are huge incentives to stay in power. Now, before there were parties, there was bribery, there was log rolling, okay? Now, maybe this is not so nice words for just getting to know people and doing friendly things, but there were, in other words, there had to be some way of producing coherent majorities. And party discipline, since in British Columbia, I understand, since about 1903 in provincial politics, party politics has been the way of producing that glue. So if you don't have parties, then you have to find something else to produce majorities. Again, there's a slide later on which we will deal with that. Any other questions? Yes.
Yes, if the premier resigns or the government's defeated, does it force an election? What's the result?
It's a good question. Technically, no. If you look back when party discipline was weaker, then, say, in the 19th century, late 19th century and early 20th century, then governments came and went as there was shifting support in the assembly. But as party discipline has got stronger and as people have felt that they should have more say in the formation of governments, then now it's assumed that if a government is defeated, then there has to be an election. If the Premier resigns, not necessarily. If the Premier is sick, if there's a split in the party, for example, and there's a major ruction, then you may have to have an election. But so if it's a change of government in the sense that one Premier resigns in favour of a different mix of support in the Assembly, then the chances are there will be an election. But there doesn't have to be. That's what the defeat on the floor of the House means. That means that the government was thrown out, but someone else went to the Lieutenant Governor and said, don't worry, don't have an election. There's another group of people who can form a government. Prime Minister King, have you heard of the King Being affair? It's in the 20s. That's what happened there. There were three parties, two of them formed a government, and then one of them formed a minority government, and then the other two said, we can get together and form a government without an election. And the Governor General said to King, when he wanted an election, no, you can't have an election because I think there's a government, an alternative government. And that didn't last very long. And then Mr. King fought the next election, saying the Governor General interfered in the process of government. He should have done what I told him. He should have called an election. Okay, and slightly off the point. So the answer is yes, you can change governments without election, but usually a change of government that's a different composition of support in the Assembly now required would be assumed to require an election. Yes?
I posted a question on the Citizens Assembly website about exactly this, and it was about in the Parliament, do all votes Are they held through a secret ballot, or do they show a show of hands? Because if it is always a secret ballot, in other words, a free vote, wouldn't that more or less eliminate the discipline question?
You're right. That's one reason why they had so many governments in Italy, because voting in the assembly was by secret ballot. So you could say one thing and do another. No, the essence of parliamentary government is that you vote physically. You go into one lobby or another. You physically take yourself there. And from my point of view, you can't have parliamentary government unless these members operate freely and frankly and indicate what they're supporting. How do their supporters know what they're doing unless you see them actually voting? Now, different systems have, some parliaments have electronic voting now, but traditionally, you physically went to the left and to the right of the speaker, of the chair, and you filled up. And it took a while, and that was one of the techniques the opposition did to indicate to the government that it didn't like what it was doing. The opposition couldn't stop the government doing it, but it could slow down by constantly calling these divisions. The House will divide. And it may take 20 minutes, you know, to everyone go out and then they count it and then come back in again. So every section of the bill, they'd say, call for a division, so on and so forth. Okay. Yes?
Is there a mechanism to replace the lieutenant governor?
Yes. It's called the prime minister. The governor general appoints the lieutenant governor and can remove the lieutenant governor. And the Governor-General acts on the advice of the Prime Minister. Therefore, the Prime Minister can remove the Lieutenant Governor. Yes?
If there's a vote and one or more of the members vote against the party of their choice, are they usually disciplined in the sense that they're expelled from the party, or is there other mechanisms that come into play?
Well, that's up to the party. And you can see in the current legislature what happens if you annoy the governing party. Then you may be either asked to leave, you may leave, you may be expelled from the caucus, the parliamentary meeting. But that's essentially an internal matter within the party. It's up to the yes.
So there's no set rule. It's just up to the individual party itself.
Yes, technically people are elected as independent members. The fact that they only get there most of the time because they've got party labels is a matter of convenience or whatever. So, yeah. Okay. Jean.
Go back a little bit. I just want to understand the mechanics of what happened. You said since the cabinet or the government is at the pleasure of the premier, say the premier dies, or in the case of in BC recently, a premier resigns, how does the government continue?
Someone goes to the lieutenant governor and says, I'm sorry, here's a death certificate, whatever, this person is no longer with us. I am the acting leader of this party, and I can guarantee I'm from the same governing party that the premier was, and I can form a government. And that either I am going to be there permanently, or I am going to be in this office and I will call on you again because I may be there only for a while. But yes, it's just the same process. Okay, this process has been going on for the best part of 150 years. It's a part of the British monarchical parliamentary tradition. So the system's, you know, they've got a bit of experience, a bit of routine, a bit of momentum. They know how to do it now. Okay, let's go on to partisan majority governments. Once you've got parties, the government is assured of a majority. The government can veto legislation. That means if the governing party doesn't like it, then that's it. You can't have a member of the opposition party trying to pass legislation, trying to introduce legislation the government doesn't like. The government can just vote it down. Voting in the assembly is by party blocks. Important discussion is in the party room, not in the assembly. Now, it doesn't mean that nothing important happens in the assembly, but it means a lot of critical decisions are made in the party room, in the governing party, and not in the assembly. And it means, in general, that the assembly business is controlled by the government. The timetable, when it meets, whatever. So if you've got a majority government, it can subordinate the assembly a great deal. And the net result is the scrutiny of government is greatly curtailed. The scrutiny of government by the assembly may be scrutinized by the press or other people, but it's not scrutinized by the assembly because, for example, the opposition wants to set up a committee into something the government doesn't want to be investigated, and of course those are the only things worth investigating. The government will say no. It's not required. We're in charge. We're looking after the provincial interest. Trust us. A bit more on parties. So if you've got that kind of system, in sum, the government dominates the legislative process. The Assembly's major function is reduced to airing matters of public concern. Now, this is no small matter. This is important because it means that members in the Assembly can stand up and raise things the government doesn't want raised. It can say things that would be defamatory outside. It can use it as a forum to embarrass the government and try to make the government disclose things. So, for example, when the government in Ottawa meets, I suspect there'll be some odd questions about the Arar case and whatever, right? But it means that the news media and the courts become more important for political opposition than the government, to the government than the assembly. Now, we need the news media and we need the courts, but if you have an assembly which is dominated by the government, then the assembly becomes a relatively less important player. It's got many, many important functions, but in terms of scrutiny, it becomes relatively less important. What about coalition and minority governments? What are the differences between majority coalition and minority governments? Now, here are some fine diagrams. You've got them already, and to a certain extent, we've dealt with these things before. The colours are arbitrary. They just happen to look nice. They don't represent any particular parties. They're just notional. Okay. This is the kind of stuff we're used to. We have a majority. That little 50% in the middle is the break-even point. So if you've got more than 50%, you control the assembly and the government. If you've got less, you can't. Now, that's a blue party majority government. That's what we've got. And the government of the day, that little bit on stalk, is the premier and the ministers. So they're quite happy they've got a majority. They are the government of the day, the premier and the ministers. However, in past times, the kind of situation David was talking about earlier, there were kind of parties, but they were very loose associations. They were kind of tendencies. They were people who joined because they supported a particular policy, or they admired a particular leader, or they were hoping for office. And they were sometimes called ministerialists because they wanted to be ministers and drive around in the equivalent of a big white car. Okay, that kind of system with very loose party discipline, our government had variable support, the blue government. It could have been defeated on the floor of the House quite easily, and it would have to work constantly, both to secure a majority, to stay in office, and to pass its legislation. So, if you like, that's a kind of halfway house between no parties at all and tight party discipline. These are kind of groups in the assembly who form majorities for the purpose of maintaining a government, passing particular pieces of legislation, and those things may change. So that hasn't been around in BC since the turn of the 1900s. But what happens historically in Australia, not so much here, but in other parliamentary systems throughout the world, the Red Party, just fortuitously, happened to form a new kind of party with party discipline. And it was a party with a large structure outside the parliament. This is the kind of stuff Ken will talk about this afternoon. And that party had strong party discipline and forced its members to vote as a bloc. And this was seen as revolutionary, as changing the whole structure of the parliamentary process, because it meant that debate in the parliament, for example, couldn't persuade people because you knew how they were going to vote. Okay, so the example I've got there is there's a blue government with variable support, and a new emerging Red Party with tight party discipline. And, of course, because the Red Party did well in elections, then in due course it became a majority and forced the other parties or party to form the same kind of organisation. And then in British Columbia that happened sometime after 1903. Now, maybe the discipline wasn't as tight as it is now, but that process has been around for about 100 years. So once you get a well-disciplined party with a stable majority, the government doesn't fear about defeat, it knows it can pass its legislation, then the worst that can happen is it gets defeated and the other party comes in. Okay, are there any questions about that? That's really what we've been talking about with those previous slides. Yes.
So if the majority government gets voted out or resigns and all the ministers resign, then can the opposition come in and take over?
Exactly. Then it depends on the system, but one system is the lieutenant governor would call on Joanna Bloggs and say, I see you've, would you come and call on me and have a cup of tea or something, and could you form a government? And that's Joanna Bloggs, leader of the party who just got a majority of seats at an election. So the same process. Called up, you're given a commission, you go away, you come back with a list of ministers, you form a government.
So the people have no say in that election-wise? It's just done sort of within the election year?
Yes, the person who's called upon is entirely at the discretion of the lieutenant governor.
Right.
But given that the person is usually the leader of the party that's just won the last election, there is not much doubt. There are occasions when there is doubt, and that's what makes politics interesting. But usually, there isn't much doubt. Okay, I'll come on to the doubt very shortly. And there is doubt, okay? There you've now got three parties. I'm sorry, another party. Yes, another question.
Yeah, in the event of a resignation, doesn't the deputy premier come into play in a situation like that?
He or she may. It's a matter of constructive knowledge. If the party in power says the premier has resigned or died or whatever, you're the person who's going to get the call. But again, there's no rule that says that. But that's what usually happens. Yes.
So if the government falls and the leader of the opposition goes to the lieutenant governor and says, I would like to form the next government, does the lieutenant governor have to consider that, or can they just arbitrarily say no?
You're invited. You don't go there. You don't knock on the door. You're invited. Yes. Yes. It's difficult to...
So it's at the lieutenant governor's discretion?
Yeah, it's a kind of to and fro. You've got it's not as though it's... I mean, she can read the newspapers as well as the next person, and she has advice and whatever. But let's look at this case. This is an interesting case, because here we have three parties, and the 50% mark, neither red nor blue have control, but with the gold, it's not very gold, is it, but goldish, that party is necessary to form a coalition to give a majority. Now, you could have blue and red form a coalition. You could have a kind of grand coalition with them all form governments, but let's say that it's red and gold. There, the lieutenant governor would usually ask the leader of the red party and say, can you form a government? And the leader of the red party would say, well, yes, I have talked with the leader of the gold party, and we together will form a coalition government, and that means that we'll draw ministers from both the Red Party and the Gold Party. Now, on occasions where this happens, sometimes there is dispute. Sometimes the leader of the Blue Party would say, me, you should ask me, because I can form a coalition with the Blue Party. So sometimes the information is unclear. But if there's a doubt, the lieutenant governor may say, I will call Parliament and we'll see if you've got the support of the Assembly. We'll have a vote of confidence. And if the red and the gold parties support, you have a majority and it sticks, then you're the government. If, on the other hand, it doesn't work, then I will call on someone else. Okay. Now, as you see in the notes, these coalitions can be formed at the last dying moment or they can be formed long before. People can campaign as part of a coalition. Okay. Now, I've got another one. Now, this is getting... This is the most complicated of the three. Not that complicated, but... This is a situation where the Gold Party doesn't like the A Party, and it doesn't want to form part of a government with the Blue Party. Okay, it doesn't want to be have ministers. It says, well, we've got to choose something, and we think we favour the Blue Party in government rather than the Red one, but we don't want any ministers. And we'll do a deal with the Blue Party, and we'll say, we'll keep you in office, but we reserve the right to not to vote for some of the legislation we don't like, and as the price, perhaps, not necessarily, of the price of being government, we want you to pass a law on X and Y. So there's a kind of informal deal. Sometimes it's a semi-formal deal, but it's a deal done by the Gold and the Blue parties that the Blue Party will be in government, the Yellow Party, the Gold Party will support them, but not have ministers. So it's a minority government because the Blue doesn't control a partisan majority in the Assembly, but it's kept in power by the support of the Gold Party. Okay, so minority governments, as you see in some following slides, are very interesting. They don't happen very often. BC hasn't had one since 1952. But they do occur, and if you change the electoral system is changed, then they might become more frequent. Yes?
If the Gold Party does not decide to support any, under that, would then the Red Party form its own minority government, or would the Lieutenant Governor call another election?
Well, this is when the life of a Lieutenant Governor becomes interesting. The wise Lieutenant Governor, if in doubt, would leave it to the Parliament, the Assembly, to decide. But you're right. If there is, it's unclear. For example, supposing the Gold Party is made up of half a dozen independents. And who do you call on first? Do you call on the Red Party because it's got more votes than the Blue Party? So it's not a huge problem, but it would be seen by the press. Of course, not the current press, of course, but the press in general as being revolutionary, because here was the people had made a choice and there was no clear government. And the answer was, well, the people made a choice. It was because they made it clearly a sensible choice. But it's not quite clear who's going to operate the government. So I'd say these circumstances are unusual, but they can happen. Okay. And, just to make it really complicated, the more parties you have, the more the possible combinations. There you have a three-party coalition. And you can play around with that. So you get the general idea. Majority government is easy. You've got a majority of seats by one party. Coalition government, you've still got a majority, but that majority is made up of two or more parties. Minority government, the government doesn't have a majority of seats, partisan, but it's got support in the Assembly for it to continue. Okay, now I'll go over that in these slides very quickly, I hope. So a coalition government with a majority may not be too much different because it has a majority, but it may have to compromise a bit over policy with its coalition partner. The opposition will always try to look for ways of sticking a knife in between the two parties to make them fight, and with any luck, the government falls. And there's always the possibility that the coalition will collapse, and then the government would fall, and then there would be usually an election. But by and large, coalition, there's no reason if the coalition is a good deal, why coalition governments are any less long-lived than majority ones. Of course, when they come to fight elections, it's a different story. Who do you blame? Anyway, but by and large, that's an electoral problem, not a governmental one. Now, what about minority governments? Well, they're quite different because the government doesn't control a majority. The governing party relies on the support of another party, as we've seen, to stay in office. The supporting party doesn't have any ministers, but trade support for influence. So that's really what those diagrams were about. So, if you've got a minority government, it makes a big difference to the parliamentary process. For starters, the government doesn't control the business of the House. They want to extend the sitting, they extend the sitting. They want to extend question time, they extend question time. They want to set up committees on something the government doesn't want, they set them up. Okay. So there's a huge change in the dynamics of the parliamentary process. Discussion of a policy now takes place in the Assembly. Just think of it. You discuss the merits of legislation in the Parliament. Okay. And changes to legislation can be made without the consent of the government. The government can say this is an important bill, and the Assembly can say, well, it may be, but we don't like Section 25A, and they can delete it. Okay. Now that is not just enhances the ability of the Assembly to scrutinise, but it affects how governments behave. It means they are under constant scrutiny. Things like ministers start resigning on matters of principle. Because, of course, the Premier knows that if a minister is an embarrassment, that supporting party, those independents or minor party that keeps them in power, may say to them, you've got to fire that minister, otherwise we'll force the government to resign. So the dynamics change. Governments become much more open to scrutiny. Ministers can be forced to resign. The Assembly can force an election. That minor party withdraws its support. The government falls. There's an election. Now, those are I don't know whether those are good things or bad things, but it's difficult for governments to act without compromise. It means the government must be constantly saying, well, I've got to persuade the Gold Party members that this is a good piece of legislation. And the Gold Party may say, well, that's okay, but we want this and this. We want these groups to be consulted before you do that, and the government must do it. It means that unpopular things become more difficult for the government to do, for better and for worse, because the government is fearful that its support will be, its life will be curtailed. And it also means that assembly members, legislative assembly members, members of the legislature, MLAs, become more subject to lobbying. In other words, the lobbying, if you get a majority government, most of the lobbying is done on the public service, because that's where the decisions are made. They advise the government. So the idea is to have lunch with, if you can have lunch with Gordon, that's great. If you can't have lunch with Gordon, you have lunch with heads of departments and things like that. You can influence things that way. And that, of course, continues under any system. But if you have a minority government, it may pay to have lunch with the odd MLA. Particularly a Gold Party MLA, because they can influence the shape of legislation. So if you like, the focus of political activity moves a little more towards the Assembly. It becomes more the focus of influence. So minority governments make Parliament a major check on the government. This has a major benefit in terms of government accountability and transparency. Some would see costs in terms of policy uncertainty and the ability of governments to make unpopular decisions. There's no such thing as a free lunch, that for every benefit there is a cost. So finally, I think, any electoral system can produce majority in coalition and minority governments. So any, as BC can show. Just, it depends how the votes fall. BC has had majority, it's had had coalition governments, and it's had minority governments. Any system can produce it. But plurality and majority systems are more likely to produce majority governments, and proportional systems are more likely to produce coalition and minority governments. Again, there's no guarantee. Just because you change the electoral system doesn't mean you change the way the system works. But there is a tendency, if you like, there's a logic in each one of those electoral systems to move in that direction. Okay. Now, before I go on to the questions consideration, questions, any other questions? Yes. Tanya.
I just want to ask a question. You've done a really good job of presenting the BC parliamentary system to me, and I got so far as understanding that the lieutenant governor is accountable to the prime minister. Is that correct? Or the prime minister can unseat the lieutenant governor?
Yeah, it's not really an issue. Technically, the lieutenant governor is issued a commission by the governor general. And it just so happens that the name given to the governor general, the representatives of the crown only act on advice. So whenever the governor general does something, unless it's a tour of the Arctic, okay, it's on the instructions of the prime minister. And the same with the with the lieutenant governor in BC.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's just a practice. It's a convention that the governor, it's the prime minister who gives the name.
Right. So I'm just trying to understand the whole connection to the Queen back in England. It kind of goes like Queen, Governor, General, Prime Minister.
You should think of the Queen as the mechanism for appointing the Governor General. She really has no role to play in the Canadian system at all. Okay. The only, well, except when she, you know, crown appears here and there, but as a monarch, she has no role to play except in the appointing of a Governor General. So really, Canada operates, and Australia, as a republic. It's a kind of crowned republic because the head of state acts in the name of a distant monarch. But really, she plays no role. And that line is of accountability, if you like, is not really the accountability that counts. It's the head of government who's responsible. Everybody knows it's the head of government. It's just that some things are done behind this mask of the lieutenant governor or the governor general. Yes. Yes.
I was wondering if party discipline tends to be stronger in systems with proportional representation versus what we have now.
Sorry, could you repeat? I missed a couple of words.
Oh, sorry. I was wondering if party discipline is different in systems which produce coalition governments versus ones which tend to produce majority governments, or
it varies. You can have coalition. Governments which are coalitions between very tightly organized parties, or you can have coalitions between loosely organized parties. The only thing is that they have to stick together, otherwise the government falls. But how the parties operate is a matter of their own internal dynamics, their own internal rules, and in some ways how long they've been a coalition. So really the big difference between coalitions are ones that are done at the last dying moment and ones that have been kind of in the works for a while. For example, the national government in Australia now is a long-standing coalition between the Liberal Party, whose leader is Mr. Howard, and the National Party, whose leader is Mr. Anderson. And they've been coalition partners since the 1920s for most of the time. Doesn't mean they like each other. But they work together, have a routine for working together. Yes. Yes, David.
You've talked about coalition and minority governments. Have there been any studies in the impact of coalition and minority governments on the public's perceptions of politicians and on voter turnout in subsequent elections, and on the effectiveness of those governments?
From my knowledge, yes, no, and yes. there was a period in the 80s, late 80s, and in the 90s, when, fortuitously, there were a large number of minority governments in Australian state governments. And a colleague of mine and I did a study of that. He was the major player in that. And what was interesting was that minority governments tend to be interested in process. That's, they tend to be interested in the way Parliament operates, particularly if those minorities are the balance of power held by independent members. And our impression was, it certainly affected the way the parliament worked in the way that I've demonstrated. Premiers were forced to resign because they'd done things that normally they would have just laughed off. Whether it affected turnout, I don't know. It certainly affected the visibility of the parliament. Not necessarily favourably. The press, for example, doesn't like, by and large, minority governments because they're seen as being unstable. Maybe the press in, obviously The Sun is an excellent paper, it's given us excellent coverage, and maybe they would behave differently. But by and large, the press likes things to continue predictably. So at least the press in Australia was critical of these minority governments and longed for the day when majority governments would return. Whether it affected turnout, I have no knowledge. But on the other hand, in Australia, it's compulsory. Everyone has the joy of voting. Otherwise, they pay a $20 fine. Frederick, the last one.
In the case of a minority government, would the government fall at any time when the supporting party withdraws its support? Or the government will only fall when they fail to pass any major legislations?
The second one is the one. In other words, the government would put it the other way around. The party that withdrew its support would have to know or would flag to the government whether it was defeating the piece of legislation because it didn't like the legislation or whether it was trying to throw the government out. So in a minority government, usually minority government would fall only on a vote of confidence, and usually that would be explicit. So someone would say, if it were an opposition party, remember, I move a vote of no confidence in the government. And if the Gold Party members walked across the floor and into the lobby with the opposition, the government would fall. But on day-to-day pieces of legislation, no. The government doesn't like this happening, and usually it does deals before things get into the legislature. But no, if it's a piece of legislation that is not viewed as a matter of confidence, the government would continue. Okay. All right, now I've got questions here, and then these questions, they're not quite the same as the ones on your list, but they're pretty much the same. They're things for consideration. What should assemblies represent? I wouldn't spend too much time on that because to a certain extent, you've already come at that from a different point of view. What role can assemblies play? How does the parliamentary government work? The facilitators are full bottle on this stuff. They can answer questions. And what are the costs and benefits of coalition and minority government? I have an announcement, and that is that about where you go after this for the breakout sessions. Salon A and Salon C are no more. There are no more meetings down in the concourse, partly because they were noisy and partly because the logistics of the hotel required it. So now, if you will find some of you have a thing in your have a little sticker inside your tent label which says gallery, third floor gallery east or fourth floor gallery east. Not surprisingly, they're on the third and fourth floors, and they're on the east end, and it looks like a long table sticking out in between a kind of pillar or two. We hope that will do. We'll test drive this. If it doesn't work, we may have to think again. Okay.
Thank you very much, Campbell. Don't quite yet go away, but pretty soon. That your name card you should take with you, and it will say, it doesn't say east, by the way, it just says gallery, third and fourth floors. That just means there's going to be a discussion group outside of the rooms. It's just in the open area there rather than using down below. Because, again, one of the comments you guys made to us last time was it was very difficult hearing down there, so we're not using the concourse. Quickly, you've replaced your bio sheet. You've got nice now color photographs of yourselves and everything else, and you look so much better. The old ones, if you don't mind, there's a box at each door, a cardboard box. If you don't mind throwing your old one in there, so recycle them.
Secondly, if you've had any problem hearing in here, by the way, we do have headphones at the help desk. So when you come back this afternoon, for example, and if you want headphones, you can get them. Okay, we're going down to the concourse for coffee. Discussion groups at about 11:15 and lunch 12 in the concourse and back here at 1:00. Thanks very much.